This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. My name's David Brett, and on today's show, with vaccines on their way, we look at the few positives to emerge from the pandemic.
This is like the first time that I recall in the 20-something years of following the sector that there has been this apparent genuine collaboration between the sort of the commercial players, the pharmaceutical biotech companies, and also the academic community to come up with a solution.
How we might go about vaccinating the world.
So yeah, there's quite an interesting debate on vaccination, which is who do you prioritise? And there's, I guess, two arguments. One is, do you vaccinate the people most at risk of having bad health outcomes, or the people that are actually the main vector of transmission, the kind of super spreading kinds of people.
And the fascinating future of healthcare.
We're at a very interesting juncture right now in that we've got three forces that are coming together.
Hello, how are you? I hope you're all safe and well. You know, before this year, most of us probably never actually considered what it takes for governments and companies to get us the healthcare we need. That's because for most of us, it's there when we need it. Few of us can barely perceive the amount of work, effort, and investment that goes into bringing us world-changing healthcare solutions. That is until something big strikes, like a pandemic.
In central China, a man has died following an outbreak of an unknown pneumonia-like virus, which officials say comes from the same family as the deadly SARS virus. Health authorities say that only 40 other people are infected.
As we enter the fourth month since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, I'm deeply concerned about the rapid escalation and global spread of infection.
When you get community spread, it makes the challenge much greater. So I can say we will see more cases and things will get worse than they are right now.
Now we're relying on a healthcare industry to get us out of this crisis. An industry that was expected to be worth $11.9 trillion by 2022. That's according to an article in Business Wire. But that was pre-pandemic. Imagine what it's worth now with all the resources thrown at it to help us get us out of this crisis. The healthcare universe is huge, spread across areas including the study of human genes, artificial intelligence, tech, big data, and so much more. Not just the big pharmaceutical names like AstraZeneca and Pfizer. But they've all come together to get us through this pandemic. But how are we going to get out the other side? What's the plan for vaccinating the world? And what does it mean for the healthcare industry going forward? To find out, we're going to speak to a fund manager and a specialist in healthcare investment, John Bowler. We've also got Mark Ainsworth. He's head of Schroder's Data Insights Unit, and he's going to help colour the conversation with some nuggets of data around the pandemic that help inform the investment decisions. We'll chat about how we vaccinate the world and what healthcare investment looks like in the future in parts 2 and 3. But in the first part of the show, we're going to look at what we know about the pandemic so far and the vaccines, and starting with how the markets responded to the vaccine news.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
The first vaccine was announced by Pfizer and BioNTech on November the 9th. The markets responded accordingly.
Now we have perhaps the first convincing signs of a COVID bounce in markets. Look at today. So actually early on in the morning, at the start of trading, there was a bit of an increase. Some people have put that down to the confirmation of Joe Biden becoming president-elect. And then look what happened at 11:30. So when that vaccine was announced, you had a very big increase, up by about 4% in the following.
That was how Sky News broke the story that day. But it wasn't just the FTSE 100 that shot up. Global stocks all rose on the hope that the vaccines would bring some kind of normalcy back to life. Investors have since ploughed almost $90 billion into global stocks in the last 3 weeks, the largest inflow of money into equities ever, according to Bank of America data. The FTSE All World Index ended November up 13%. But were there any surprises in the market reaction? John Bowler.
I think the reaction was quite logical in the sense of you know, the vaccine was seen as a catalyst for a return to some kind of normal life, whatever that might be in the future. But in terms of the obvious things like the companies, the industry that were most impacted by the COVID lockdown, so you think of travel, hospitality, and some of those industries, those are the kind of sectors that have performed the most strongly. And if you think specifically within the healthcare sector, I mean, what you saw as the instant reaction was actually some of the kind of a similar kind of response in terms of some of the companies that have benefited from COVID. So think of some of the companies offering diagnostic services to test PCR testing for COVID vaccine. They were, those shares were marked down, but the ones that benefit from elective procedures, hospitals and say the orthopedic implant companies, which have been impacted by the shutdown of hospitals due to COVID-19, they responded positively on the announcement.
The stock market continues to creep up, perhaps holding something back just in case vaccines, which are due to start in the UK in the week beginning December 7th, don't work. But it's worth bearing in mind that some indexes, like the UK's FTSE 100, are still well below their all-time highs. With stock markets on a tear, as they say in the industry, meaning rising sharply, it's worth taking a look at the global collaboration it's taken to find a vaccine for the virus and its potential impact on how the healthcare sector works going forward.
There's some really positive things that have happened in this experience. I mean, this is like the first time that I recall in the 20-something years of following the sector that there has been this apparent genuine collaboration between the various players, you know, the commercial players, so the pharmaceutical biotech companies, and also the academic community to come up with a solution. I mean, I think, you know, the consistent message from the kind of leaders, so the larger companies in the industry, that they see it as almost like a duty to provide a solution for society, and it's part of their kind of national service. And so I think so that and it's I think that's one of the reasons why and it is that putting the best minds all working on the same problem globally has led to a very fast response to the situation. And I think in terms of, you know, other factors, I mean, clearly the impact of lockdown has forced changes in how companies, so healthcare companies, do business, but also, so whether it's the pharmaceutical biotech companies or even, you know, the health service providers. So you've really seen, you know, I mean, telehealth and the use of kind of virtual communications already existed before COVID-19, but I think it's really, you know, proven its worth and has become a much bigger place going, has a much bigger role, will continue to have a big role going forward in both how these companies do business in terms of selling pharmaceutical products, also developing pharmaceutical products, but also how clinicians interact with patients.
The pandemic has cost 1.5 million lives globally so far and infected 62 million people. That's according to the World Health Organization. It's ruined economies and livelihoods. The global economic growth is expected to fall 4.4% in 2020, according to the International Monetary Fund. There are few positives to come out of the pandemic, but as John says, the way in which the healthcare community has come together to tackle the crisis is one. But what are the broader lessons we've learned so far from the pandemic? Mark Ainsworth.
Yeah, I think there's three key things that I would draw out as what we've learned about this pandemic. First of all, the virus itself is clearly at least 10 times more dangerous than seasonal flu. So, and that continues to be a point of debate in certain areas about, is this really something to be worried about? But the evidence is very clear. This is a much more dangerous disease than seasonal flu. And so the extreme reactions the world went through are in some ways justified. The second thing that's become quite clear over the last few months is that it's very clearly seasonal. The fact of people gathering indoors because it's too cold outdoors and gathering in you know, the effect that the winter season has on the likelihood of virus to get into people's systems mean that it's got a very strong seasonal effect, and that's why it's a big challenge through winter for all the Northern Hemisphere. And I think a really interesting thing that's been visible through the pandemic is that the countries that have had the least bad health outcomes, they've managed to control the epidemic most effectively, have had the best economic outcomes. So oftentimes there's a sort of debate about saving lives versus saving the economy, but that's a false choice. The evidence is, when you step back over the whole year, that the countries that have handled the virus best have also supported their economy best.
So evidence suggests that it doesn't have to be a choice between saving lives and saving the economy. Countries in Asia especially seem to have avoided the humanitarian and economic disasters experienced so far in the West. So what is the common thread that runs through the countries that have done well at both?
There's two common themes, I would say. I think one is just effective civic administration. So there are a lot of things that need to be really well organised to control the virus. I think Korea springs to mind as a place that have very well organised processes for doing contact tracing, for example, and Germany is another place that springs to mind in that respect. But the other thing is that all the actions people need to take to stop the virus spreading are ultimately actions that cause a little bit of personal sacrifice for the greater good. So wearing a mask is a bit irritating. Staying in your home is an inconvenience to your life. There's all sorts of actions that people need to take. And I think there's probably a common theme, which is the places have controlled it better, have a general, the balance of focus on the community versus liberty is that little bit different. And so America epitomizes being at the other end of that scale, where people's desire to have personal liberty causes them to do things that spread the virus more.
Strong leadership and some self-sacrifice should be a given during a crisis of this magnitude, but clearly not in some countries. But given what we know works better, what is being done now to prepare for future pandemics?
I think many of the countries that did a very good job of controlling the outbreak are the ones that suffered very seriously from SARS many years ago. And I think there's quite a real sense in which that experience galvanized those countries into the investments in the ability to contact trace and manage epidemics in the future. It sort of equipped the populations to recognize the value of establishing those capabilities. So I would assume that many countries of the world will, you know, when they have an opportunity to reflect on all this, will conclude that it is worth spending a lot of money every year to have a standing contact tracing capability that would allow them to stop the virus before it got going in a way that, broadly speaking, places like Korea and Taiwan did, rather than trying to get, because once the virus gets up to a certain level, contact tracing cannot help you. There's too many people infected and infecting each other for contact tracing to work, whereas places like Korea were able to do that. And I think they had that capability because of their previous experiences with SARS. So I would assume that lots of countries will go through that exercise and expand that sort of public health capability in the future.
We are nearly a year into the pandemic, but we are beginning to see a light at the end of the tunnel. Vaccines, they're on their way to help. So in the next section of the show, we're going to look ahead at how crucial the next 6 months are and how we go about vaccinating the world.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
This is the news that we've been waiting to hear. Pfizer and BioNTech reporting the first results from their phase 3 vaccine trial, saying that in this interim look, the vaccine showed to be more than 90% effective in
that
preventing
new hope in the battle against the coronavirus. 1 week after that news from Pfizer, tonight news on a second vaccine, Moderna, announcing its vaccine is nearly 95% effective. It comes just as
we start this newscast with three big developments happening on the coronavirus front. First, the University of Oxford and AstraZeneca reported that late-stage trials of their COVID-19 vaccine were, quote, highly effective in preventing disease, preventing about 90% of people from developing the coronavirus. The results,
the first successful trial was announced by Pfizer and BioNTech on November the 9th. Since then, there have been two more, one from Moderna and one from AstraZeneca and Oxford Biomedica. All have claimed to have an efficacy rate above 90%, although there is some conjecture over the AstraZeneca trial, which we'll get to shortly. To put the efficacy rates into context, the widely used measles vaccine is 97% effective, and the seasonal flu vaccine is between 40% and 60% effective. But how do vaccines work? Well, they use something called mRNA, which stands for messenger ribonucleic acid. Bear with me. Here comes the science part. mRNA plays a vital role in human biology, specifically in a process known as protein synthesis. mRNA is a single-stranded molecule that carries genetic code from DNA into a cell's nucleus to the ribosomes, the cell's protein-making machinery. Proteins are the workhorses of the body. Nearly every function in the human body, both normal and disease-related, is carried out by one or many proteins. mRNA medicines are sets of instructions, and these instructions direct cells in the body to make proteins to prevent or fight disease.
We've evolved to fight infections, and one way of fighting viruses is when there is any naked DNA or RNA in the blood, there are enzymes that would digest them, break them down. And so the key is delivering the messenger RNA to a place where it can have an effect. And in terms of what's really quite different about this approach is if you think of a conventional, traditional vaccine, you are introducing a protein that is mimics what appears on the surface of the pathogen, the virus or the bacteria you're trying to generate immunity to. The way you produce those proteins is quite a complex iterative process that takes time. What's different here is that you're getting the body to make its own vaccine. So you're administering the software, so the body makes its own vaccine, which is why it's quite different from conventional approaches. And the key benefit of that is what we've seen this year is the speed with which these companies were able to generate candidates to enter human clinical studies, whereas typically it would take, 6 to 12 months to develop a candidate that could start clinical trials. Moderna and BioNTech had candidates ready within a month. So all you need is the genetic sequence of the pathogen, and specifically all three are going through targeting the surface so-called spike protein of the COVID-19 virus. Once these products are approved, that's the final step. Once the regulator has gone through in detail through all the kind of the efficacy and importantly the safety data on these trials, and some of these trials are large in size. This is sort of a validated technology. So this will become kind of proof of concept. And the companies BioNTech and Moderna, because their sole focus is the use of mRNA. I mean, they already have other vaccine candidates in development for diseases that are actually very difficult to produce a conventional vaccine for.
The mRNA technology appears groundbreaking, providing the vaccines, of course, are approved by the regulators. The signs are positive, though, as the UK has been the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. That was on December the 2nd. But it hasn't all been plain sailing. There are concerns over the results from the Oxford Biomedica trials. But how concerned should we be?
So the overall problem with the Oxford trial is that there are different statistics being talked about in terms of the efficacy of the vaccine. Overall, 70% of the people who had the vaccine administered avoided getting COVID, but a subset of people had a different dosing. They had a half dose followed by a full dose, and for those people, the efficacy is 90%. There's two things a bit troubling about that. The main thing is that it's a bit of a puzzling dosing, and in fact, what's happened was they didn't mean to give anyone that dosing. The fact that several thousand people received that half then full dosing was due to administrative error. So that reveals that there's a bit of a how well organized things are is a bit concerning. But secondly, the fact that they're publishing statistics on multiple different ways of measuring the people in the panel indicates that they may be looking at lots of things, and they may have selectively published the stats that look best. And fundamentally, Oxford are trying to catch up with the very high efficacies published by Pfizer and Moderna. But both Pfizer and Moderna had pre-announced exactly how they were going to analyze the data. So there's no particular concern that they've been cherry-picking the best numbers, whereas that is a legitimate concern about the Oxford trial.
Nevertheless, I think it's worth mentioning that the US regulator, the FDA, their minimum requirement for efficacy is 50%. So regardless of the difference in efficacy between the different vaccines, they all beat that threshold. All these companies have published data from earlier studies where essentially all they were looking at was the immune response to vaccination. So the data doesn't tell you anything about whether it prevents infection, but what it tells you is, what it tells you is how your immune system reacts to the vaccine, to give as a kind of an assurance that they're working the way that you'd hope they work. And I think that the consistent thing is actually that these vaccines are effective in elderly people as well as younger people.
Normally, with the level of efficacy we have, 95%, 70% or so of the population being immunized would allow for true herd immunity to take place. That is likely to happen somewhere in the month of May or something like that, based on our plans. I really hope and look forward to seeing that the level of negative perception of the vaccine decreases and people's acceptance increase. That's going to be critical.
That was Moncef Slaoui, head of Operation Warp Speed, which is in charge of producing and delivering the vaccines in the US. Now, there's roughly 7 billion people on the planet, and each person needs 2 doses of the vaccine. So that's 14 billion doses needed to vaccinate everyone. But Slaoui said, with a vaccine efficacy rate of 90%, it will take 70% of the population to get immunised, to get herd immunity. So we need at least 5 billion people to be vaccinated globally, and that's 10 billion doses of the vaccine. But in a normal year, between 3 to 5 billion doses of vaccine are created to treat all viruses and diseases. So you can see the challenge facing authorities, which is why they have to have a plan to prioritise. So how do we go about vaccinating the entire world?
So, yeah, there's quite an interesting debate on vaccination, which is who do you prioritise? And there's, I guess, 2 arguments. One is, do you vaccinate the people most at risk of having bad health outcomes, so the elderly and others with other diseases, or the people that are actually the main vector of transmission, the kind of super spreading kinds of people? And I think, generally speaking, there's a clear consensus, which is if your goal is to save lives, you vaccinate the elderly first. And I think partly that's because those are the people that are most at risk, but also because it's much more practical. From a public administration point of view, it is a simple matter of fact, what is your age? Whereas identifying the super spreaders is actually super hard. So that's a very reasonable way to sequence it, is to prioritise frontline healthcare workers and then the elderly. That does mean that it will take a while before the people being vaccinated are the main transmitters of the virus, and so it won't be until a fair portion of the population have been vaccinated that those vaccinations will materially start slowing down the virus spreading in the community. So winter will continue to be a situation where the virus is still spreading in places like America. And then another aspect of this is actually this question of what is the herd immunity threshold. So for example, measles, that threshold is about 90% of the population. Now, this number is deeply linked with the R0 number that is often talked about. This is the transmission rate of the virus. So because measles, R number is about 10 to 12, that's why you need 90% plus of the population immunized against measles to stop it spreading. The truth is we don't really know the R number for COVID, the R0 number, the natural rate, because it is partly culturally specific. But there are some nuggets of information to really try to pin this down. One of the interesting ones is a city in Brazil called Manaus. It's in the sort of Amazon region. And as of August this year, 2/3 of the entire population of that city had been infected. And yet they were still experiencing continued outbreaks in that city. So that shows you that in that kind of city, in that sort of country, the herd immunity level must be at least higher than 66%. So, and then places that are you know, different sorts of cultures where many more people in rural areas, that proportion may be lower. But it's clear that a lot of people do need to be immunised to stop the virus spreading.
It goes to show just how much is unknown about the virus. So don't put the champagne on ice just yet. That uncertainty might go towards also explaining why countries like Australia have warned casual travel in and out of the country won't be allowed until late 2021. Which begs the question, how do we get the world moving safely again?
Yeah, I think there's obviously lots of complicated things to think about with that. And in particular, in a world where half of the population are vaccinated and half are not, how to manage that in a way that feels fair. But from a sort of transmission risk point of view, there's much to be said for the idea of immunity passports. There's one example that springs to mind, which was an outbreak that happened in a way centre, lots of kids with some adults looking after them earlier this year in America. And they allowed people to come to that, either if they had proof that they had a negative test recently, or if they had proof that they had antibodies, so they had immunity through prior infection. And unfortunately, one of the people who attended that tested negative, but in fact still had the virus sort of incubating in their body, and they caused a huge outbreak in this, you know, this group of people. But none of the people who had their certificate that showed that they had immunity from a previous infection that had antibodies, none of those people caught it. So that's very clear reinforcement of that idea that if you've got something that proves that you have immunity, you are probably safe, you're not going to get it, you're not going to spread it to other people. And out of a desire to have various industries get back to normal, like airlines, I mentioned that there'll be a lot of pressure to allow people to start doing that, whether that's that or the kind of thing that's happening currently, which is that a succession of negative tests would also let you prove that you're safe to travel. So I would imagine that immunity passports will become a thing in various parts of the economy.
It would be great to have more freedom, wouldn't it? The pandemic has really brought home the freedoms we took for granted. But the long-term efficacy of the vaccines is still unknown. However, the more confidence we get in the vaccines working, the closer we'll get to life returning to normal. When that happens, economists expect the global economy to go gangbusters. The IMF expects 5.2% growth in 2021. So in the final part of the show, we're going to look ahead and compare short-term winners to potential long-term outperformers. As we mentioned at the top of the show, we've had a dramatic rebound already in global stocks. The FTSE All World Index rose more than 13% in November alone, meaning it was up 10% for the year at that point. That's remarkable, considering we've had a pandemic which closed large parts of the global economy. There are reasons for that, of course, including the fiscal and monetary policies of governments and central banks, which have benefited stock markets more than many other assets. We've seen big gains in travel and leisure and cyclical stocks like banks and oil should the vaccines take hold. But could there be more to come?
I suppose some of the other factors there will be, you know, in terms of restarting the economy again, what bottlenecks have been created by the shutdowns. That's going to create some maybe some one or two potential surprises in some of these sectors. But in general, I think that there's still probably further to go there.
But this has been a year focused on the ability of the healthcare sector to deliver solutions. In the case of vaccines, this has been done on an unprecedented scale at an unprecedented pace. If we're to beat future threats, then more investment is needed in an already massive industry. That's already happening, of course. For instance, in 2018, investments in pharma and biotech alone were worth $28.3 billion compared to $8.5 billion in 2010. That's according to analysis from McKinsey. And it won't be just private investors pouring money into the sector. There'll be pressure on cash-strapped governments to do so too.
The budget issue is going to become even more acute once we've, you know, all the governments have to, you know, deal with paying back all the money or thinking about managing their budgets, given how much has been borrowed during the course of this year. So I think that creates an extra impetus for better management of the resources, which requires fresh thinking and adoption of these technologies that demonstrate these kind of, not only does it benefit the patient, but also it benefits the healthcare system in terms of cost.
So the pandemic has only exacerbated existing demand for healthcare solutions, and the companies which operate in it will garner even more interest. But given what we've been through in 2020, have the drivers behind the demand for healthcare changed?
I mean, the key drivers remain unchanged. We're at a very interesting juncture right now in that we've got three forces that are coming together. I mean, we have sort of demographics and aging populations, and specifically, if you think in most developed countries, it's the leading edge of the baby boomers. You know, they're reaching sort of 75 years of age, and that is a time where there is an inflection in terms of the kind of serious, the kind of conditions they need treating. This is where, you know, hips need replacing, where more complex cardiovascular or heart procedures are done. So there is going to be a step up in demand for healthcare services that is going to be a driver for several years to come. And added to that, you know, we will still return, and probably going to be made even more of an issue given the kind of budget issue, the issues that most economies will face, is that there is going to be a need to focus on reducing waste and making the provision of healthcare much more efficient. And this is where the third force, technology, comes in. And we've already seen some examples, the role of new technologies such as the mRNA approach to treating, to dealing with new disease situations, but also the fact that the use of technology, specifically telehealth, digital communications, has changed, and it'll be a permanent change of how healthcare is provided. So I think that these will just continue to develop, given the pressing needs from the growing demand and the need to become more efficient. So I think there is a long runway to run with this theme.
But it's not just about big names like AstraZeneca and Pfizer.
I think with healthcare there is. You know, you've got to think of that there's a broad set of opportunities, and there's a number of different business models that'll be necessary in servicing this healthcare need going forward. So you have the digital health companies. There is the kind of more modern healthcare providers that use telehealth. There's the in terms of digital. There's the thinking about companies kind of involved in remote monitoring of patients. So there's examples such as Livongo, which link for a diabetic patient, they link to their glucose monitor and collect data real time from the glucose monitor, whether it's a traditional finger stick system or one of the newer continuous glucose monitors. And these provide kind of inputs that they can then send behavioral prompts to the patient to better manage their disease, and they can, you know, they've already demonstrated quite clearly that by the combination of the data plus AI derived behavioral prompts, they can improve patient outcomes, clinical outcomes, and also save healthcare systems money. And this is why their adoption is still growing rapidly, but it's still very early on in the adoption phase.
Coronavirus isn't the first pandemic, and it won't be the last, unfortunately. But countries' budgets are stretched and debts piling up. Governments, therefore, will have to spend their money wisely in preparing for the next big global threat. But it will help to know what that threat might be.
Other than another pandemic, which there will be more, there's no question about that. It's just a question of when and whether the countries they start in can stop them spreading before it gets too late. I think the other sort of unlikely but very serious risks that should be thought about, there's a couple of obvious ones like asteroid strikes that are extremely unlikely, but the impact would be so bad that it would be worth spending some money to protect against it. But I think the key one that people should be paying more attention to is the risk of a coronal mass ejection. So that's a ejection of a load of plasma from the sun, in the solar wind. And so the last time a big one of these happened, which was in 1859, it basically brought down the whole telegraph network, and if that were to happen today, it might well take out huge parts of the power grid of all the countries of the world. It would probably cause all the satellites to stop working. And for the power grid in particular, the bits of equipment in the power grid that would be damaged by that, the transformers, the sort of manufacturing capacity for those is, it may well be the case it would take a year or longer to get all those electricity grids up and running again. So that's a kind of low-risk, high-risk, but low-probability event that would definitely be worth the world investing a bit more money, making sure that it doesn't affect us as badly as coronavirus has affected us.
As if future pandemics weren't enough to worry about, so there's plenty for governments and investors to mull over. But please, don't have nightmares. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, go to schroders.com/insights. If you want to listen to more, it's schroders.com/the investor download. Remember, you can rate, review and subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. New shows are available every other Monday and every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. And if you want to get in touch with us about anything in the show or ideas for new shows, you can contact us at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. But above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.